Blog. Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. Today I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Shweta Vikram. She is the author of a poetry chapbook, Because All Is Not Lost. The book is a timeless piece of work by an incredible, incredible wordsmither, and she delves into loss and grieving. Grief, depending on the relationship with the one deceased, affects us differently. Shweta reflects and tributes her own feelings and thoughts in this book. But before we chat with her, I'd like to introduce her to you. Shweta Vikram is a multi-genre writer and marketing professional. Born in India, Shweta spent her formative years between the steel city of Relika and blue waters of North Africa in the green hills of Missouri before arriving in the bustling New York. She is the author of two chapbooks of poetry, Kaleidoscope, An Asian Journey of Colors, and I understand that's going to be published at the end of August. And the one that we're going to be talking about, is Because All Is Not Lost. And she is the co-author of a poetry collection, Whispering Rose of the Ganges and Zambezi. Her debut novel will be published by a firm in India. Shweta's work has appeared in, or is forthcoming, in literary journals, online publications, and anthologies across the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, India, New Zealand, and the Philippines. Shweta has held several artist residencies in Europe and America and has worked on a collaborative project with artists from Zimbabwe and Australia. She is a graduate of Columbia University, and she lives with her husband in New York City. Hi, Shweta.
Hi, Irene.
I'm so glad to be talking to you, and I just want to tell the listeners that I had the opportunity to review your book, and I loved it. I loved the way you write. I love your wordsmithing. It's very creative, and it just really touches the heart.
Thank you so much. That's very generous of you.
You write about losses, and you have mentioned that you have two losses that really impacted your life, and I'd like you to talk about that.
Sure. The two people that I talk about in my book, Because All Is Not Lost, are my paternal grandfather, whom, you know, in India and Hindi, we call him Dada, and my mother's sister, my Masi. And I lost my Dada when I was about 5 years old, and my mother's sister passed away last year. And both of these people were one of those rare few who took, like, extreme interest in what I wanted to do versus, you know, what the society expected of me as a woman, as a girl, or, you know, as a South Asian who should study medicine or law or any of those professions that, you know, promise, like, a very dependable life. And I think that's one of the reasons I've been reflecting back upon why is it that these losses have impacted me more than anything else, is because my last interaction with both my Dada and my Mausi was, you know, their last words were them encouraging me to follow my dream. I remember my Dada had throat cancer, and, you know, he'd lost his voice, but every evening when I would go to the hospital to visit him, he would actually write down a request on a piece of, you know, he would ask for a pen and a piece of paper and write down his request on that, the song that he wanted me to sing, or if I could do a little dance for him, and he couldn't even move his arms that well as to applaud, like he would basically scribble. Mm-hmm. But he, you know, there would be tears flowing down his cheeks every single evening. And, you know, when you're five, you don't really get what that meant. But he always encouraged me to pursue the arts. And that was the same thing with my Mausi. When, you know, my first book came out, she actually sat down with me and, you know, went through each of the poems and told me what she liked and, you know, and discussed the emotion behind each of my works. And I think that really meant to me. So with both of them gone, you know, I have my parents alive and they're wonderful people, but the artist in me in some ways feels orphaned, if that makes sense.
It does. It really does. And it just touched my heart when you're talking about your Dada, that at 5 years old that you were able to go and visit him at the hospital. How special is that? So, Shweta, as a five-year-old, what kind of grieving process did you go through when he passed away?
I You know, come to think of it, I've thought about that question a lot, and I don't think I really went through any grieving process. You know, you're a five-year-old, and you just have so much depth or grasp of what's happening around you. And we, like, you know, my dadah lived in the same city when he was sick as my parents did. So our house was, like, flooded with people. So, you know, my immediate family was busy taking care of everyone else around. So I don't think any of us got the time to really grieve. But it's the older I get, it's like my roots call out to me. But roots meaning, you know, the people who supported me through the arts and, like, my dadah especially. And it almost feels like I'm grieving over him now, and the more I write, the more of the art stream that I pursue, it's almost like I'm keeping my promise to him.
Wow, that's really special, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and I feel really blessed to have had him in my life. You know, again, given where I come from, it's a very dumb thing for people to follow certain professions, and you follow career paths which are very dependable, not really into the art stream or one of those things. And for him to have had this, you know, this foresight, like, decades ago, to be able to think that this isn't about what others think about my grandchild, this is what my grandchild is good at, and for him to have had that perspective, I think I feel very blessed.
No kidding. You know, you're so right, because that the older generation quite often doesn't see it that way, and so that is really special that your grandfather was able to do that.
Right.
And so now, as you reflect back to him, and, you know, of course you were only five, but was there anything specific that you can really remember that really influenced your life at that time, and that you're actually fulfilling that now?
Absolutely. I don't smoke. My grandfather, you know, he ate, that was this one vice in him. Mm-hmm. And I think we all have our vices. And his weakness was tobacco. And that's what killed him. He would chew tobacco.
Wow.
And, you know, that's what caused through his throat cancer. And he was hospitalized for 6 months, and I remember everything vividly, even decades later. And I think I wish he didn't do that. But what I've learned from that is I never want to touch tobacco, because I've seen what it's done to him, and it's such a sad coincidence. But even my Mossy, my mother's sister, chewed tobacco. And they both died 2 decades apart, and, you know, I lost both of them to tobacco. So I can't chew tobacco, I can't smoke, whether it's a cigarette, a cigar, or any of those things. And, you know, when you're younger, and I pretty much grew up in boarding schools and hostels, it's very easy to sort of fall prey to peer pressure, but I never did, because that sense of reality was so deeply rooted in my subconscious that I couldn't care what anyone thought if I was being weak or averse because I didn't smoke. I just couldn't. It was just too vivid.
You know, that's really amazing that at five you got that message.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because usually at 5 years old, that's sort of the last thing from your mind. But, you know, as you grew up, that reflection still stayed there with you. And it's interesting that decades later, your Mossy had passed away from the same issue.
Right.
Okay. It really instills in you what not to do.
Absolutely. And I think when you see someone you care about suffer as much, I almost feel like age has nothing to do with it, because it just leaves imprints, you know, both on your subconscious mind and your heart, pretty much, if that makes sense, because you're not consciously trying to understand what's happening at that age especially. But you know, when I saw him, he couldn't speak, and he was a very dear man. Like, you know, my mother was very fond of him. We all loved him. And for a man as dear as him to not be able to even say his last words, because for 6 months he just scribbled things on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that left an everlasting impression in me that, you know, willingly I would never want to put myself in that position.
I understand. Shmeta, how about reading a piece from your book, Because All Is Not Lost? I'm sure our readers and our listening audience would love to hear your wordsmithing.
Thank you, Irene. The poem that I want to read today, it's titled A Note to the Biggest Thief in This World. And this poem is sort of very dear to me for just its attitude and its tone in terms of we, you know, as human beings. I mean, I would consider someone lucky if they say they've never dealt with loss, but I think most of us have, you know, lost someone or something really dear to us, and this is almost like a challenge, a note to loss that, you know, that you cannot consume us. Mm-hmm. And we will fight you back. So the poem is titled, A Note to the Biggest Thief in This World. This letter has to be written, not in blood or tears, left by the failing tide, though you would like that, a feast of human vulnerability with an extra portion of drama bread. That is not happening. I won't bore you like a woodpecker. I intend to keep my emotions inside a wordless closet. But my convictions are here to flow, uninterrupted, like the night that sleeps with your secret. We are flesh and blood, no weeds in our veins. Every time you prowl, our hearts cringe like dogs infected with ticks in their necks. We carry home silent weight through puddles, blame, guilt, ache, stress, etc. Every stone seems to be a grave. Snow sings the blues, breaking branches of bald trees, a cold morgue. The wind pricks pine needles into raw wounds. You wear a blindfold. A tremor makes us reach for the ground. A geyser of overwhelming agony floods families, faith, and confidence, paths for sculptates. But you should know, we will smile with thin lips and vivid eyes. We did at one time. We learned to read between the lines. The volcanoes will dry. We won't bathe in the stream of melancholy forever. If anything, there is a lesson to be learned from the sad tales in the old book. A new path can be carved out. To cherish the lush meadow of what's left behind and not roam dark alleys where phantoms bite like rodents, there will be silver rain. Frost will flow. The apple tree will bloom, and you, loss, will become insignificant as our hearts and minds hold you by your toes and toss you far away from the lantern of hope so you don't regenerate like a lizard's tail. Thank you.
That's beautiful.
Thank you so much,
that
Ari.
That is beautiful. Listeners, as I said, the wordsmithing is just so great. I mean, frost will flow. You know, things like that. There was other things in this poem that you had said, and like it just really touched me. The one thing that I want to talk about is the one line that you have read, and you say, I intend to keep my emotions inside a wordless closet.
Right.
I would like you to just explain that a little bit more, because it seems that, to me, it sounds like, you know, you really want to keep all those emotions inside and not let them out. But yet letting them out is part of the grieving process.
Right. I think it's part of that, and part of what I personally believe in is keeping inside a wordless closet also personifies not doing the blame game. Mm-hmm. It's so easy, you know, when we lose something to point fingers. Because it's so easy to sort of find nirvana or sort of like a solution when you have someone to blame for it. And if at that moment, you know, when you're at the peak of the grieving process or the peak of the moment when you feel anger, disgust, and loss of faith in this world, if that's when you can control, you know, the words that pour out of your mouth,
mm-hmm.
and that's true for all of us, I feel, is the moment that I refer to. That would be the wordless closet. Because then when you get to the other phase where, you know, you have a little more of your brain doing the thinking and less of the heart, it's easier. And it probably what you say is what you mean then, rather when the heart does all the thinking. And that's when I'm a very pragmatic person, so it's just a very pragmatic approach. When you're that upset, like my mother would always tell me, you know, count to 10 when you're really angry, and by then you will realize that you want to use your head to think, not your heart. So it's just that approach.
And I understand that. When I used to see when my kids were angry with each other, I would send them for a walk around the block, and thinking about it, and by the time they came back, it wasn't even an issue anymore. And there's just a change of perspective.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today we're speaking with Shveta Vikram. As if you have heard so far, Shveta is a charming woman that is able to articulate grief and loss in a very positive manner. She can be found on ShvetaVikram.com, and her book title is Because All Is Not Lost. You mentioned about blame, and right now in the news, I mean, on every broadcast, the big issue right now is the Ground Zero Mosque.
Right.
There's just so much blame on the Muslims as a whole and not just a small group that actually initiated this. So what do we do?
It's interesting you bring that up, Irene. I just blogged about this topic earlier today because yesterday a group of friends and I, we got into a heated debate about the Ground Zero Mosque issue, and my heart goes out to moderate Muslims and my heart goes out to every human being. But I feel this issue has just become more political than it should be. And if you personally ask me, this shouldn't be a federal issue whatsoever. It should be the, you know, the officials of New York or people living in New York who should have more of a say. And so I have nothing against any religion, but I also get, and this is what I was trying to explain to my friends, you also have to get where people come from. Everything said and done. Today, if, you know, the Ku Klux Klan decides that they want to go into deep roots of Harlem and create a shrine there, or, you know, I mean, if the Germans decide that they want to go into Israel and create a little shrine there with the best of intentions, you know, the emotions are still raw. It wouldn't be seen that way. Mm-hmm. To me, that's one point. And the other point is, it's not just people of a certain religion who were massacred on 9/11. There were Muslims who died. There were Hindus who died. There were Christians. There were Jews. There were people from all religions. So why are we making it a religious place? Mm-hmm. I mean, if anything, the city, there should, if you ask me, there should be a shrine for the people who died that day. And if anything, there should be businesses for the built around there, and the money should go to people who've lost, like, the primary breadwinner in the family. And we're talking about, and, you know, I understand that, you know, there have been certain states in the United States where they're very upset because, you know, they don't want to build mosques in their communities, which I think is completely incorrect because that's your First Amendment. I mean, you should be allowed to follow or practice your religion. But when it comes to Ground Zero, I don't think it's so much of a religion issue as it's become political, and it's also an emotional issue. So I don't think there is a right or a wrong answer, but I personally feel there's just so much of political involvement right now, and maybe it's got to do with elections. You know, everybody, end of the day, every politician has an ulterior motive because that's what they do for a living. And it should be just brought down to the state level. Let the New York officials decide what's best for the city.
It'll be interesting how this will all end up eventually. So
I agree, because it's just so blown out of proportion at this point.
It sure is, and you know, and how much longer is it going to go on for? So, Shveta, how about another poem?
Absolutely. You know, since we were talking about blame, and I think half the problem in this world is either we feel guilty about something, or you know, we blame someone, and a lot of times survivors, and I've, you know, noticed that with my friends and family, survivors have a survivor's guilt.
Oh yes.
And you know, this poem touches about on that whole concept of survivor's guilt, and it's called "I Cannot Emphasize Enough." It's not your fault that it was a hot summer day and my mood was withered. It's not your fault I decided to leave work early to stomp out a black moss of anger. It's not your fault I drowned my eyes with sand and didn't see signs of the dark rain. It's not your fault I distracted my lips with pale fumes as I boarded the train, which never moved. But it will be your fault if you don't claim the dusts of grief, throw them into the oblivion, and move out of this transient world.
Wow.
If I may say, this poem, the inspiration of it was the local trains in Bombay a few years ago were they were bombed, and there were, like, bombs planted. And my father-in-law works in Churchgate, Bombay, where, you know, we've had several attacks. And he was going to be on that train, and a meeting came up at work. And he was delayed, and he missed that train. And, you know, my husband and I, we've thanked our stars every single day. And that's what got me thinking, that think of the people. Like, it was, I don't know if it was like a karmic thing happening or if it was just a coincidence. But, you know, thankfully he missed the train. But what about the people who didn't miss it and they didn't make it back home? And this is a tribute to all of them, to the survivors of their families.
Wow. And, you know, you were talking about guilt. A lot of people do take on the guilt, don't they?
They absolutely do. And I also feel guilt is such a cultural concept, and it varies in its flavors across different cultures. I can tell you, you know, when my grandfather, my dada, passed away, my dadi pretty much gave up her life. You know, she lived with one of her sons, and everybody was nice to her, but it was almost like she had lost her will to live. She existed. She didn't live. And I always wonder if that was the case because, you know, she was a woman versus my uncle, my mother's brother-in-law, that is my aunt's husband. You know, I mean, he went on with his life. He's going back to work. You know, on the fifth day, he was back to golfing. And I'm so proud of him for doing that because, you know, my aunt is gone. But you can't just sort of let go of yourself because that one person is gone. I'm not saying it's easy. But, you know, he didn't take it as a guilt thing. He decided to live for his children, for his grandchildren. And I thought that was a very beautiful concept.
It is a beautiful concept. So, Shweta, what do you think that people take on the guilt?
The one thing I always feel is how you go to bed. Okay, let me make sense of that absolutely nebulous statement. You know, the one thing that my parents always told me was never go to bed angry. So whatever squabble you might have, you might not like it, but never go to bed angry because you really don't know what happens when you wake up in the morning. And for me, with a lot of people, you know, I've seen, especially with friends, given I grew up like in hostels and stuff, so you sort of get introduced to a very diverse and eclectic blend of people. So people come from various backgrounds. They carry their own baggages. And a lot of people that felt guilt was their last interaction with the person who had passed away wasn't the best. If, you know, so this,
right,
this person dies in an accident, the last time they spoke was they'd had an argument the night before. And incidents of those sorts. So I think it's always that guilt. I think part of the guilt is that, and part of it is, like, just, I know, like, the way my dada's wife felt. Like, how do I live? I mean, why am I entitled to this life when he's gone? So people lose a sense of purpose with that one person gone.
You know, that's a really good point, that loss of purpose. And I think that probably what I'm thinking of is this is also fear-based.
Absolutely.
Because there's maybe been so much dependency or codependency on the other person that they're just not sure. All of a sudden they're all alone, and they're not sure how to act or react.
Absolutely. And I think, it still exists to some extent in today's generation, but I notice a lot with my mother's generation or my grandparents' generation, to your point, Irene, like, there's a lot of codependency. And so it's almost like roles are carved out. One person managed the house and the kids. One person was the breadwinner. So if the breadwinner is gone, all of a sudden, you know, you're dependent on many levels. And then if something happens to the lady of the house, like, including the husband, everybody felt sort of orphaned, of which I think because of the way the equations are in today's world, I think men are very self-sufficient and so are women. So, of course, you're emotionally dependent, but, you know, you're not physically dependent as much on each other.
Exactly. Exactly. And you had just mentioned an important point that here in America, women are, you know, they have equality, more equality than a lot of them do in other developing countries or underdeveloped countries. And so I think that, you know, our next generations are coping differently here because we're more independent, whereas I think that probably women in other countries don't find that as much.
Oh, no, you're right about that.
Uh-huh.
And so you've traveled a lot and you've lived in many different countries. And what has your experience been?
You know, I grew up in, like, extremely different continents. My parents were in North Africa for 15 years, you know, and women have a very different place in the sense when we would visit my father's co-workers, women were rushed into one living room and men were taken into literally a separate house with a separate living room. So there was people of only the same gender interacted, but not with the opposite sex. Versus in India, it was never that way. Not the, you know, not the society or the community I grew up in. Mm-hmm. People mingled with each other, but you know, it was always like men had an edge up, probably because they were the bread earners, or you know, the society. It's a patriarchal society, end of the day. But those equations have really changed, and you know, I always say hats off to the men from my generation, you know, Indian men, because they went from, you know, seeing like their dads placed on a pedestal to their wives or their girlfriends or their partners saying, hey, we are equals, and you know, how are we any different from you if we can do what you can do?
Mm-hmm.
So that has really influenced my writing. In fact, you know, I have another book of poetry coming out in about a couple of weeks, I want to say. It's called Kaleidoscope, An Asian Journey of Colors. And that book actually talks about, you know, people really like the colors in a South Asian woman's wardrobe, like a Hindu woman especially. You know, we have all these reds and oranges and pinks, but, you know, there are a lot of emotions attached to that.
Mm-hmm.
So a shade of red might mean something else to the society. It's like for a Hindu woman, and you know, I'm Hindu. So for a Hindu woman, red is the sign of being married. You wear a bindi, which is a red dot, or vermilion on your hair. But red is the book also talks about red is also the color of your blood. So it's the emotions that red is also the color of your heart. So every shade has an emotional value for a woman and, you know, a societal value for it.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading that one, too.
Thank you.
I love your reading. Now, you've got another book coming up, a novel, and it's going to be addressing a lot of the societal issues that are going on right now. Let's talk a little about that.
Yeah, sure. This book, tentatively titled, is called Perfectly Untraditional, and the book is about an immigrant, you know, who moves to New York from India, and she finds the truth about herself after moving to this country. And she finds the truth about her mother, who's completely doting, and her father, who's abusive and alcoholic, and they all have a reason behind the behavior. It's a very South Asian tendency. We are very non-confrontational by nature. And so the book addresses all of those issues and the issues that permeate your society today, be it, you know, the place of women in the world, or, you know, be it like gays' rights or being a Muslim in today's world. It addresses all of those issues. So though it's a piece of fiction, you know, it's, and I wouldn't even say it's inspired by true incidents, but it is inspired by the issues that consume us today. So I'm very excited about this book. This is my first first fiction novel.
Well, that's great. Gosh, Veda, this has been a real pleasure talking to you. And listeners, she has such incredible, and I'm going to say it again, wordsmithing. This is the best book of poems I have ever read. I just like, it's wow. To be able to transform the thoughts and feelings to words is incredible. And the name of the book is Because All Is Not Lost. Veda, tell us your website address.
It's www.shweta, S-W-E-T as in Tom, A as in Apple, Vikram, V as in Victor, I as in India, K as in Kite, R as in Roger, A as in Apple, M as in Mary.com. So it's shwetavikram.com. And thank you so much, Irene. It was such a pleasure talking to you. And, you know, your questions are so insightful, and I really appreciate you taking out the time to discuss this book, the issues that are consuming today's world.
Well, thank you again. Listeners, again, it's Because All Is Not Lost by Shweta Vikram. And so this is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye for now.